This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. It's a historic time for the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford. For 86 years, USJ has been an all-women college, and now male undergrad students are welcome to enroll in the university's undergrad program. Coming up, we'll speak to the president of the school about why USJ made this decision. Is this change being welcomed by female students? We'll also hear from Inside Higher Ed about whether USJ's decision mirrors trends among other traditional same-sex higher ed institutions. Are you a USJ alum? What do you think about this change? You can join our conversation coming up later. Also, Connecticut manufacturing has been growing in recent years, but are local companies being impacted by President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs? We'll find out more with the news editor of the Hartford Business Journal. That's just ahead. But first, the state has recently settled a lawsuit filed by a former inmate of the Connecticut Department of Correction. 39-year-old Wayne World sued the state, alleging the medical staff employed by DOC through a contract with UConn Health committed medical malpractice by delaying care and treatment for skin cancer. Meanwhile, more suits have been filed against the Department of Correction. We wanted to know more about this story, so joining us now in studio is Connecticut Mirror reporter Mackenzie Rigg. Mackenzie, welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I should also tell our listeners, if you want to join the conversation, the number 860-275-7266. You can email us, where we live, at WMPR.org. And as always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Mackenzie, I mentioned that the state recently reached a settlement with former inmate Wayne World. Tell us about him. What happened to him when he was incarcerated?
So he was serving a 17-year sentence for manslaughter. He first went to medical staff in 2012 for dark patches that he had on his skin that he said that, according to the suit, he had had for some time and what medication responded, but his condition started to worsen. Those affected areas became lesions and blisters, and he started to request more and more care. And so, like you said, the suit claims that the correctional staff and the medical staff there failed to properly treat and identify his skin cancer. And this lawsuit goes into many details about the many medical visits he had, the many prescriptions he was prescribed, and so forth. But one of the most telling lines in this had to do with kind of how he was being treated. And at one point, he was regularly covered in gauze and covered in topical creams. And it became so bad that his sores would bleed through the sheets. And so it took from 2012 to 2015 for him to first be diagnosed with skin cancer. He was released on medical parole on May 7th, so he is out right now. Last week, Wayne and state officials did sign the settlement. The state agreed to pay Wayne $1.3 million. But I think it's important to note that in the actual settlement, it does say that Wayne owes the state about $700,000 in incarceration and other costs. They cannot go after that from his settlement money. And his attorney thinks it's highly unlikely the state will collect on this because Wayne, because of his condition and his disease, cannot work right now, but I thought that was like a really interesting point to make sure I highlighted in the story that while he's getting this money, there is this
the state's hoping to recoup some of the incarceration costs.
Yeah, and his attorney really, like I said, thinks it's really highly unlikely and didn't seem alarmed by it, but it was a part of the settlement that I had to take a step back and ask a few questions about. And his settlement comes at a time when, like you said, there are other suits pending. And this really growing concern, public concern, about how inmates are getting their mental and medical health care and whether or not we have a systemic issue going on.
So because we know someone that's been incarcerated or have experience with the prison system, walk us through who are the people that are actually in charge of delivering medical care to inmates?
So for 20 years, it was through UConn Health Center, UConn Health, and they had a contract through DOC, and in some of the prisons, there's actual medical units, and some there's not. And if someone needed specialized care outside of the prison, it would have to be reviewed by a committee of doctors. And one of the things that was said at this six-hour-long hearing was the fact that it was sometimes very hard to get this specialized care, and that requests for this could sometimes be delayed weeks and so on. And this is definitely highlighted in Wayne's suit about his request for a biopsy as well as getting an outside view from a dermatologist for his skin condition. But now, since July, the actual Department of Correction has taken back management of the healthcare for inmates. But a lot of the same employees that worked for UConn Health doing this, the physicians and so forth, have come on as well. But they're definitely in the midst of a transition, and we're kind of all waiting and seeing how things play out with this new management structure.
You mentioned this informational hearing that happened in July before lawmakers. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from State Senator Heather Summers, who's a Republican from Groton, co-chair of the General Assembly's Public Health Committee. But something that, if you could walk us through a little bit of somebody that actually spoke at this hearing was former Chief Medical Officer Dr. Joseph Breton. This is someone that was in the job for 3 months, and I believe I understand that he resigned because he didn't want to have to deal. He saw that there are problems and they weren't being resolved. What were some of the things that he told lawmakers that was particularly troubling about the lag time between if an inmate was dealing with a health condition and whether they were getting the proper treatment?
So, yes, he was the head of medical, but before that, he was a doctor in the prison system. So he saw firsthand what it was like to be a primary care doctor. And one of the things he really highlighted was the review for outside care and how at the beginning, the vast majority of his requests for outside specialty care would be denied. So he learned the system and he learned what to request and not request. And even though we live in a system now where there are some barriers to care, whether or not your insurance will cover something or not, it's not the same, he was saying, inside the prison system. And so, again, there was just such an issue of delay of getting people health care when it came to specialties like dermatology or cardiology that you couldn't do inside a prison medical unit.
Didn't Dr. Breton also say that I think of all the requests that he would put in, about like 90% of them were denied by this committee that was put together?
He said at the beginning 90% to 95%, but I think what he highlighted is that he learned the system. Mm-hmm. So I think he probably saw better results later on, but he wasn't requesting things that he knew, at least gave the impression that he knew would not be approved. And that's just not the standard of care that we receive outside of the prison system.
This is Where We Live. Mackenzie Rigg is in studio with me, a reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. We're talking about issues within the Department of Correction and how medical care, again, health care, is delivered to inmates. Recently, the state settled with an inmate who is now out on medical parole. He has skin cancer, and there are other cases out there. How many cases against the state of Connecticut?
I'm not sure of the exact amount, but I know of at least two or three that are pending right now, and one has to do with an inmate who did die in custody. It was filed on behalf of him by his mother, and his mother did testify at this six-hour hearing and has gone public about his case.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome into the conversation State Senator Heather Summers. Senator Summers, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we're getting a little bit of an overview with reporter Mackenzie Rigg about some of the issues within the Department of Correction and this contract with UConn Health. You held one of these hearings to look into this alleged medical malpractice. Can you tell us what you heard?
Sure. You know, first I'd like everyone who's listening to understand that I wanted to have a public hearing, and that would mean that a hearing would oblige certain people to testify. You would be required to come testify. But unfortunately for me, being the co-chair of public health, I did not have support from the other side of the aisle to hold a public hearing. So we ended up having to have a public forum. And the difference is a forum, you have a set agenda, you have the speakers or those who are interested in coming and telling their story already lined up, so it doesn't really allow for public input. And I know at the end of our informational hearing, there was people that had wanted to testify, but because it wasn't a public hearing, we really couldn't allow that. So we're hoping that we can have a public hearing so more people can come and shed a light on what's actually happened at the Department of Corrections with the UConn Healthcare system before the transition, so we know what the issues are going forward and we can ensure that they're fixed. That's one of the big issues that we have, is if we can't see the report on 25 cases that were chosen clearly because there's issues, and we can't see why there was a breakdown of care, then how do we have any confidence that this transition is working when we don't know what the issues were to begin with. And that was one of the reasons on having this, you know, informational hearing, to really bring light to the fact that we have a system that's really gone unchecked and unfettered for 20 years. It's been a no-bid contract with UConn. Whether they wanted it or not, they've had it for 20 years, and there's been no checks and balances. And now we have situations where we have, as Mackenzie was mentioning, 19-year-old healthy men going into prison. You know, I believe that that particular person's sentence was 2 years, dying in prison, you know, of curable diseases. You know, the skin cancer diagnosis is absolutely just unfathomable, that you could go and be wrapped in gauze and bleeding through gauze and not have care for 3 years.
Senator Summers, we're short on time, but I wanted to get to the fact that you had alluded to a consultant's report, again, and Mackenzie mentioned this too, that has looked into 25 cases of possible malpractice within the Department of Correction. Again, this medical care given to them or not given to them by this contract through UConn Health. This is something that the DOC will not release?
That's correct. We have asked to see it, and we're not asking to see it to go on a witch hunt. We are asking to see it so that we can find out where the ball was dropped, so that we can make sure it doesn't get dropped again. And we have not been privy to it. We have asked that it be sent to the state auditors, which it has, but the auditors are not able to release that information to us. And again, this comes down to, how do you fix a system that is clearly broken if you can't find what the root cause of the breakdown is? And that's really where we want to go with this. And, you know, I think it's very, very important from public health. You know, there's not necessarily a lot of sympathy for those who are incarcerated to get health care, because I know on the outside, people struggle with paying for health care, you know, on their own. These folks are in our care, they're in our custody, and we have a duty to provide health care to them. And when we heard the testimony from the physicians, and I don't blame anybody who's working in that system, but we have to find out what the root cause is and fix it. And if it's understaffing, we need to fix that. If it's access to specialty care, that clearly was an issue. We heard repeatedly that this board would deny the access to the care. That's something that has to be fixed.
We did reach out to the Department of Correction through their spokesperson, Karen Martucci, and they sent us a statement. Part of it reads, as we reshape our healthcare delivery system after transitioning from UConn Health to the Department of Correction, we're focused on creating an enhanced model of services with a strong foundation of quality assurance. But Senator Summers, are you concerned with the fact that with this transition, again, the Department of Correction is going to be relying on a lot of the same people that were employed through the UConn contract to deliver care to these inmates?
Well, I believe it's something like 95%. Basically, what we did is take this contracted service through the University of Connecticut and just transfer it over to the DOC. So the folks that were working for UConn, I think it was called UConn Medical, are now working for the DOC. It's not the people. I want to stress that. It's not the state employees that are trying to deliver the care. I heard from many state employees after our informational hearing that they were distressed that they couldn't testify. You know, that's because it was a, you know, an informational hearing. We're going to have a public hearing where they can come and testify. And we need to hear from them, because we need to understand what the issues are. But it's the management of and who's in charge of that delivery system on how those folks are executed, what the staffing ratios are. I can tell you, after the informational hearing, I heard from physicians that I know personally that went to UConn, that were ENTs, and talked about how ridiculous it was as a you know, a resident. They would go in and they would have to see 1,800 patients in one day. It was impossible the way the system was set up. And it has been, you know, a disaster for years and years. Now, unfortunately, it's come to light, because now we've had either people that have curable diseases dying, or we've had people actually die in prison or give birth in cells by themselves in prison. And it's come to a tipping point that has to be addressed. You know, this legislature is in charge of making sure that healthcare is delivered to these individuals at a cost that is reasonable for the taxpayers. We've been spending, with benefits, $140 million, and this is the result. So we need to be good stewards of how our money is spent and make sure healthcare is delivered in a way that is appropriate.
I want to go back to Mackenzie Rigg, reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Mackenzie, when will this full transition be completed, and who are the people that DOC Corrections Commissioner is hiring to oversee this now?
So I haven't heard a clear time frame, but I know by the beginning of the year they were hoping to have some more of that management staff on in place. And in terms of who they've hired, I don't know exactly who they are, actually. That's not an area that I've looked in deeply.
Senator Summers, we're going to have a new governor in January. I mean, what's the expectation that with a new administration that, you know, this is still going to be something that will be resolved and, you know, we won't see these issues? Because it sounds like there are suits coming down the line more and more. This is going to be a fiscal problem for the state of Connecticut moving forward.
Well, you know, I have great hopes that whoever is the new governor will take situations like this and the Whiting forensic situation very seriously. I personally believe that whoever comes in will bring in their commissioners. Maybe some will stay. But I think a change at the top is necessary to make sure that the tone is set so that the new commissioners, whoever they will be coming in, will understand that the state of Connecticut has a duty to care for those who are vulnerable, who are incarcerated, who are in our care, and to make sure that the health care that they are receiving is adequate. There is no reason in this day and age that we should have a man dying of skin cancer after 3 years of not being treated. That's just unconscionable. And, you know, I think it would give the legislature much more confidence if we could go through the 25 cases, they can redact the name. We don't need to know the inmate. We don't need to know the number. We just need to know where the system failed. So we have a surety that it will not happen again.
State Senator Heather Summers, again, she's a Republican from Groton, co-chair of the General Assembly's Public Health Committee. Senator Summers, thanks again for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Also, Mackenzie Rigg, reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, who's been looking into this issue, among others around the state. Thank you, Mackenzie, for your perspective.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, growth in manufacturing is one, if not only, bright spot in Connecticut's economy. But how are manufacturers, both large and small, being impacted by the president's tariffs on aluminum and steel? The news editor of the Hartford Business Journal joins us with more. That's after the break. And you can join us too, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. CNBC reported that in less than 5 months, the Trump administration has collected more than $1.4 billion in new revenue from levies on foreign steel and aluminum. That's according to a recent report prepared by the Congressional Research Service. But how do the tariffs impact manufacturers' bottom line, especially in our state? The Hartford Business Journal looked into that question, and joining me now is Matt Pilon, news editor at the Hartford Business Journal. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So remind us again about these tariffs that President Trump put in place. What is the administration's long view with these tariffs?
Right. So the administration first announced these metals tariffs on various imported steel and aluminum back in March. It's about 25% tariff on steel, 10% on aluminum. And what their argument seems to boil down to is a combination of some other countries that we import these metals from. We think they've treated us unfairly in terms of their trade policies. They also make a national security justification or argument for these tariffs, arguing that there are key industries here that we need to have healthy for the security of the country.
I understand that President Trump has also suggested these tariffs are going to reduce the federal deficit. How's that view being accepted by different people?
As you just mentioned a moment ago, the $1.4 billion collected so far. So these tariffs, they do go to the U.S. Treasury. I mean, they're essentially, taxes paid by the users of these imported materials. That's expected to maybe hit $7.5 billion by the end of this year. The federal deficit is, a fair bit larger than that. I mean, $7.5 billion is nothing to scoff at. But they also haven't said, exactly how much they might put towards that. I mean, there's sort of nothing firm on that, but.
And we've seen companies say that they're worried these tariffs are going to lead to job losses, a drop in U.S. exports. But what are some of the benefits? Are domestic steelmakers seeing more business now?
Yes, they certainly are. The big steel mills, which are largely, entirely really outside of New England, the big aluminum mills as well, are sort of ramping up production as companies here, look to reshuffle their supplier mix and look for more domestic metals that aren't subject to those tariffs. But, like I said, Connecticut doesn't have big giant mills like that. So we really kind of take, for the most part, the downstream sort of negative impact of that.
Now, HBJ looked into this question of how it's impacting local companies here, and you profiled at least three different companies. Tell us about what impact they're seeing, if you could walk us through the companies you spoke with.
Sure. So, I did speak with three Central Connecticut companies, ranging from, in the dozens of Connecticut employees to somewhere between 1 and 200 employees. So, small sample when you look at the 160,000 manufacturing employees in the state and the hundreds of manufacturing companies. But between the three, and this is going to be true probably across the board, the impacts vary from sort of not so bad yet to maybe a little bit more serious. All of them are seeing higher pressure on prices for the metals that they buy. Some of them are seeing delays in some of the orders because of the ramped up demand for domestic supply. And, sort of one of the ironies of the tariffs is, it's meant to spur domestic business, but, it's also driving up the cost and demand for those domestic metals.
I understand the steel mills are now operating at or near capacity.
That's right, yeah. And and some of these mills have pushed back against companies, including those here in Connecticut, who have tried to appeal to the Commerce Department and say, we can't get enough of these products here in the U.S. We buy this specialty product overseas, and it's hard to get here. The large mills have largely been successful at sort of batting back those objections.
Tell us more about the exemption process. I understand that there is this way for companies to try to get some relief, but it's the U.S. Department of Commerce that's being overwhelmed now by this process of trying to get exemptions?
Right. I mean, there are thousands of them have been filed. Thousands of exemptions. Very few have been even ruled upon, let alone successfully. One of the companies I spoke with, Gibbs Wire and Steel in Southington, they told me that they had filed about 85 of these exemptions and not heard anything back. I spoke with an attorney who specializes in manufacturing, who said that's not at all a regular here. It's kind of seen mostly as a long shot attempt, but it is one that comes with costs, legal costs, et cetera. So some companies have said, we don't think we have a chance, don't bother, while others have gone after it.
When we think about manufacturing here, the big companies come to mind, like UTC, like Pratt & Whitney. But if you could give us an overview for our listeners about all of the little companies that provide components and how much of an impact this has on our state.
Right. Like I said, there are hundreds of companies. Some of them use, mostly exclusively aluminum, while others are going to be more impacted by the steel tariff. It's gonna vary a lot. One thing we can look at historically, in the not so distant past, is the George W. Bush administration implemented steel tariffs specifically back in 2002. They made it to about 2003. Again, just steel, not aluminum. So this is maybe a little bit more drastic here. But one study, and the numbers are, of course, disputed as they normally are, said that Connecticut lost about 2,800 jobs as a result of that, 16 months worth of tariffs. So, it sounds bad. It's well under half of 1% of the employed people in the state. People will argue back and forth on, sort of what the exact impacts might be.
This is Where We Live. And stay with me, Matt Pilon, news editor of the Hartford Business Journal. We're exploring the question of how President Trump's administration's tariffs on aluminum steel are impacting small manufacturers in our state. If you're one of them and are listening, we want to hear from you. Join our conversation, 860-275-7266. I mentioned Pratt & Whitney. One of the companies you profiled was an aero parts maker, ACMT, in Manchester. Tell me what that CEO told you about how they're dealing with these tariffs in terms of, you know, delivery delays or, you know, maybe trying to purchase more of their materials now and hoping that, you know, they're not stuck with this and not able to use it down the road.
Sure. Right. So ACMT indeed does make components for Pratt & Whitney, you know, engines. And their CEO, Michael Polo, shared with me that one thing ACMT has tried to do to sort of blunt or offset some of these impacts here is make bigger orders of this fancy, you know, aluminum, proprietary aluminum that they use, and stockpile it, to the greatest extent that they can, just to make sure that they don't see delays in their very busy production schedule. They're ordering full truckloads, never partial truckloads, to kind of ensure their scheduling. You know, the trucks come in on time, all that stuff. One of the benefits that that company has, which was unique, at least among the handful that I talked to, is they have a long-term supply contract for that aluminum from their Midwestern mm-hmm. plant. So for now, you know, they don't maybe see that immediate price increase, but they know that that pressure is there and that it's probably coming down the road.
And in your reporting, unwrought aluminum is Connecticut's second biggest import?
I believe so, yeah.
You also spoke to Acme Monaco in New Britain, and this. Tell me what they make, and you know what their response is to the tariffs.
Right, sure. So they do things like medical and orthodontic guide wires. They do springs, metal stampings, all sorts of things. So unlike ACMT, which is dealing with the aluminum tariff, Acme Monaco is dealing more with the steel tariff, and so. They are, like many companies, sort of having to pass or try to pass along, increased costs in the form of price increases where they can. But, you know, they also told me, like many manufacturers, we have, you know, months-long contracts for, you know, certain jobs where, you know, we can't just come back and immediately, raise our prices here. So my takeaway from them is, this certainly isn't a good thing. It's not helping us. One thing their president also told me that I thought was interesting, though, too, is, you know, we've been dealing with the challenge of foreign competition for quite a while now. And, you know, if I have to think about what I'm – one of the things I'm most worried about, maybe it's not the tariffs. Maybe it's finding, you know, the right employees to hire with the right kind of skills to do the job in our factory.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you spoke to these three companies. Was it hard to find local manufacturers that wanted to talk about this at this point?
I did talk to three, and they were great, and they shared a lot. And some of their there were some companies that weren't in the story that helped connect me with some of these people. It's a pretty big industry, 10% of the state's economy, but a lot of them know each other. You know, with tariffs and with Trump trade policies, it can be a bit dicey for a company, even a smaller local company, at least perception wise, to sort of maybe badmouth Trump's policies. You know, I mean, God forbid they get tweeted at, mm-hmm. you know, or something like that. I think, you know, there are some companies that maybe just want to keep their head down and sort of get through this. Plenty of others so far, with both myself and other reporters in the state, have been willing to share. Mm.
Meanwhile, Pratt & Whitney, Black & Decker, UTC, they've been more open to talk about how the impact's going to hurt them?
So those companies, I mean, some of them have disclosed, as they're required to, I believe, to their shareholders, you know, here's our best guess at what we think these tariffs might mean for our earnings this year. So, I tried to talk to a couple unsuccessfully to sort of get additional information beyond what they put out there. But we have, Stanley Black & Decker in New Britain, obviously big tool and hardware maker. They've estimated about a $35 million hit for 2018. Now, that actually could change, and it could actually become a larger number depending on what the Trump administration does with an additional set of proposed tariffs for 200 million or so on, 12,000 different products from from China. So that number could increase. It was sort of an initial number put out a couple of months ago. UTC's management has you know, kind of come out against tariffs, said, you know, we think they're bad, they're not helping us. In terms of an exact number on you know, what it might mean for the company this year, I don't believe they've come out with that exact number.
In your reporting, one of the UTC's subsidiaries recently raised prices by 3%.
That's true on things like carrier air conditionings. Although you know, I should note they did not say, you know, they didn't mention the word tariff when they did that, and you know, they sort of cited more generally you know, economic conditions. But there was speculation that with the timing that perhaps had something to do with it.
Has this you know, exposure to all this attention on Trump's policies and you know, these tariff wars, so to speak, with our other trade partners internationally, is it showing that nothing that is manufactured in our country is purely American made, that there's so much interconnectivity?
That certainly seems to be the case. I don't know of an example of, you know, many things that are 100% you know, sourced and made here. The supply chains for even the small manufacturers are global in nature, and you know, I mean, these companies worry that if you know that they've spent, you know, years building those relationships and finding the right mix overseas, and now, you know, if they have to pull back, that they could lose that, and those overseas suppliers could you know, look elsewhere to other countries, competitor countries, for that business.
Mm-hmm. Earlier you mentioned one of the CEOs saying that the shortage of labor actually worries him more than these tariffs. I'm curious, because we hear that so often from politicians in our state as a talking point. You know, are there inroads being made in your reporting and your colleagues of trying to attract talent here to work for these manufacturers?
I think manufacturing has arguably been the, in terms of a single industry, the largest focus you know, of Connecticut, say over Governor Malloy's, you know, two terms. The state has, you know, invested many millions of dollars in training programs, in, you know, grants for equipment, all sorts of stuff. Work with some of the colleges. I think, from people I've talked to, that you know, they believe it is having an impact, and it will have an impact. Mm-hmm. It's a long-term effort. I mean, you can go as far back as, you know, kids in you know, middle school, sort of how they maybe look at the kinds of things that they might pursue. So it's a long-term play, and one the state has put a lot of resources into. And I guess we'll see where it ends up. But there's definitely, I think, been some successes there. Mm-hmm.
Matt Pilon, again, is news editor at Hartford Business Journal. We'll tweet out some links to some of his stories and his colleagues as well. Matt, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. College campuses are busy again after move-in day, but this fall semester will be a historic one for the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford. We're going to explain why right after the break. And if you are a USJ alum, we want to hear from you too. Join us 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up tomorrow, with climate change come looming questions about the future of Connecticut's shoreline. Like, how will sea level rise and extreme weather events alter the shape of the state's coast? And what will happen to the people and native species who live there? Tomorrow, we're going to have some local experts join us with some insight and talk about the ways in which municipalities are planning for future challenges. We hope you join us, too. Now, it's a historic time for the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford. For 86 years, USJ has been an all-women school, but now male undergrad students are being welcomed to enroll in the university's undergraduate program. Coming up, we're going to hear from Inside Higher Ed about whether USJ's decision mirrors trends among other traditional same-sex higher ed institutions. But joining us first is the president of the school, to talk about why USJ made this decision. And is this change being welcomed by its female students? Now, are you a USJ alum? What do you think about this change? You can join us. That's 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Rona Free, again, president of University of St. Joseph in West Hartford. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I understand students were moving into St. Joe's last week. And how many of them are now the male students that are joining the undergrad program?
So, well, last week we brought in over 300 new students, and 99 of them are males. And so it's been an exciting time on campus. And I think so far everything has gone really well. The incoming students have been welcoming to male students. The new incoming freshmen, I mean, they really don't know any different. But we had probably 40 continuing students on campus as well, acting as peer leaders, orientation staff. And I think they were equally welcoming to the men. And everybody, I think, has realized that although it's a big change, it's a nice change. So,
what did you have to do on campus to ready for their arrival?
Well, our board voted last June to become fully co-educational. And we actually started the very next day changing our admissions materials, our videos about the campus. And then over the course of the year, we had a co-education implementation team that worked on everything from making sure that we would still have women's only residence halls, but have accommodations for men, to athletic teams. We started new academic programs. And we did also a lot of faculty and staff development, making sure that the climate would continue to be one that was really focused on empowering women.
Well, what are some of the factors of why you decided, your board decided to approve this last year and make, again, the program co-ed after such a long history as a single-gender school?
Well, there's evidence that shows that only about 2% of high school students who take the SATs indicate that they would consider going to a women's only college or a men's only college. And in the state of Connecticut, with about 39,000 students graduating each year, about half of them female, that meant that there were only about 390 students in state who would be really interested in the University of St. Joseph. And so we wanted to expand that base. We wanted to be able to increase enrollment total so that we could offer more programs for the undergraduate women along with the men that we would bring in. It was really critical that we have the financial resources to be able to make the transition effectively. So this was a decision that had been looked at in the past. At the time in the past, the decision was made that it wasn't the right moment. But last year, the trustees realized there were the financial resources, the institution was on very stable financial footing. And so in order to increase enrollment, offer more opportunities for undergraduate women and really create a more vibrant campus, the decision was made.
Did you see when you made this decision, you said that this had come up before, but it wasn't the right time. So I'm curious, you know, what were some of the arguments against becoming co-ed?
I think alumni loved the idea that St. Joe's would continue to be an all-women's institution. And the alumni responses that we've had were, for the most part, very positive. Most alumni said they realized the world has changed and institutions have to change along with it. For the alumni who had different views, it was really more a sense of disappointment. They were sorry that future students wouldn't have the same experience that they had. They loved their time at St. Joe's. So I think that was an important factor, is trying to ensure that those alumni didn't lose their sense that the mission of the university was going to continue to focus on empowering women. But I think we made pretty compelling arguments about the fact that we would continue to focus on empowering women. We'll keep programs. We created a new women's leadership center. We're adding new women's athletic teams. So that we'll continue to do that. That won't get lost. And in fact, we can make changes that will make the value of their St. Joe's degrees, no matter when they got them, even more valuable. And we can continue to attract more undergraduate women.
This is Where We Live. In studio with me, Rona Free, president of University of St. Joseph in West Hartford. The university is now co-ed after an 86-year history of being an all-women's college. If you're a USJ alum, we want to hear from you, too. The number 860-275-7266. We wanted to get perspective on what's happening across the country with single-gender schools. And so joining us now is Scott Jasik, editor at Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I know that you have reported on this, and I'm just curious. You've heard President Rona Fried talk about some of the factors behind USJ's consideration of going co-ed. Tell us about, you know, is this typical when you're looking at other schools that have made the switch? And I'm just curious what impact they've seen since making the change.
So many other institutions are making similar choices. So I think this is very much in keeping with a broad trend. It is, as you just heard, very hard to convince many high school women to attend a women's college, even if all the data show that they love it once they enroll. Another issue I would raise is that many women's colleges, or historically women's colleges, have a tradition of producing school teachers, health professionals, and I see those programs are offered there at USJ. And I think it's important to note that at the time that many of these colleges were created, being a school teacher or a nurse was something only women did. Now, in fact, those professions are open to others, and in fact, many people want to see more teachers and nurses of different backgrounds. So the nature of education and gender roles has also changed.
Are you seeing, though, women's colleges that still have an appeal and that are still doing well? And what makes them set them apart from other schools that have been seeing declining enrollment and have decided to go co-ed?
Sure. So the elite women's colleges, the former Seven Sisters institutions, those that have remained women's colleges are seeing quite a boom these days. They are residential liberal arts colleges, less focused on pre-professional training, and they are seeing an increase in the yield, which is the percentage of admitted applicants who enroll. And they believe, in part it's a reaction to Me Too, to the Trump administration, that they're seeing young women who look at what's going on in society as a devaluing of women and are finding a women's college to be a more attractive place to be.
Mm. Now, when you look at the colleges that have decided to go co-ed, what are the challenges in attracting male students? And what are some of the, I guess, the features, so to speak, that a college will put into play to attract these male students?
So it is a challenge. Actually, I'm impressed with the first year gender split at that St. Joseph has achieved, because some colleges really struggle. You see the creation of some of the things you just heard about, sports programs and for residential institutions, dormitories. At some institutions, branding needs to change. It's also hard because if a college has throughout its history, shouted to the world, we're a women's college and that's the best thing to be, there needs to be a little bit of rebranding to talk about the values of the institution. And then a general problem is that whether they're women's colleges or not, more of those going to higher education these days are women than men. So there is actually something of a shortage of men in much of higher education that means it is tough to attract them.
I'm curious, and I wanted to get both your perspective on this. You know, are adding sports programs the best way to attract male students? I'll start with you, Scott.
I'll say that some have, in fact, had success that way. The reality is that some men are looking for an athletic experience that they can't find at a big-time program. And so the college can recruit for that program. My guess is a place like St. Joseph isn't going to turn up in the Rose Bowl or the Final Four anytime soon. But there are a lot of male students who do want that experience.
Mm. Rona Free, again, president of University of St. Joseph. You mentioned there are 99 male students that enrolled for the fall semester. How many of them are on the sports teams?
About half of them, and that's what we anticipated. We had talked to a lot of presidents at colleges that had become co-education in the last 12 years or so to get their perspective on what helped them be successful in recruiting males, what they think that they could have done better. And we got a lot of good advice. And one of the things that was emphasized was that of the students who come in the first male class, about half of them can be expected to be student athletes if you offer those programs. And so we did that. We are offering four men's programs this year. But I think we really tried to use a range of strategies. So one of the things that we've been focusing on at St. Joe's, not just for attracting men, but for all students, is to tap into what is another trend in college students, which is desiring to be in a city instead of in a rural location. And so we've really focused on the advantages for students of being at St. Joe's, which is so close to the city of Hartford, with the corporations, the emphasis on opportunities for internships and experiential education. It's not just sports that will attract men, obviously. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things, and those are the same things that we've been focusing on to attract more women mm-hmm. to the university as well.
Tell us about some of the specific programs that you have at USJ that you think appeal to both men and women.
Well, this year we started new programs in sports management and promotion, computer and data science, bioinformatics, biochemistry. We have strong programs in the sciences, and so we have 11 incoming students in biochemistry, which is pretty large for a school our size. So it's a range of programs. Scott's right that we have most of our students in nursing, health-related occupations and disciplines like nutrition. And we're really working hard at trying to do things that will attract men into those majors. For example, creating special transfer agreements for EMTs, for veterans, for example, who may have had some medical experience, to try to get men into the traditionally female occupations and disciplines. And we'll do the same thing with women, do what we can to get women to go into the disciplines that at other institutions are traditionally more male-dominated.
Now, Rona, I'm curious, if USJ had not made this decision to become co-ed, what do you think the long-term impact would be? Have you seen declining enrollment? Would costs be going up for prospective students?
I think we did have alternate paths that we could have taken. We could have continued to increase reliance on graduate programs. We could have let the undergraduate program get a little smaller, but we talked about all those options with a very big task force that we created with alumni, with current students, and they all agreed that they would like to expand the traditional undergraduate women and came to the conclusion that co-education, for us, it might not be the right thing for other institutions, but for us, this was the best way to go.
Scott Jasek again from editor at Inside Higher Ed. Before we end the show, we are curious now that more and more students are out expressing non-traditional gender identities. So how do single gender schools deal with that?
Many of the institutions that are still women's colleges have adopted new policies. Historically, they've said as long as you are a woman at the point of enrollment, they have not kicked the student out who may transition to become a man. But increasingly, women's colleges are admitting students who may have been born a woman but whose identity is male and are transitioning, or born a man and who are transitioning to be a woman. So they are admitting students based on their identification as a woman, not just their at birth legal status as a woman. And it's important for many of these institutions because they see themselves as on the cutting edge of protecting the rights of everybody and being a supportive environment for everybody. And this is an issue in a way that it isn't at a co-ed institution.
Mm. And one thing you said earlier, Scott, about fewer men enrolling in undergraduate programs across the board, is this something that with decreased enrollment that, schools are thinking about in terms of, if they're not enrolling now, like how do we attract them to our schools so we don't see increased costs down the road?
Many are very concerned about this. Some institutions are admitting that they're basically practicing affirmative action for men and admitting men with lower grades and test scores than women. Others are rethinking their marketing programs. Co-ed institutions are looking at adding athletics. There are some who say this is kind of unfair in that much of society didn't really care at all when for decades enrollments were dominated by men. But there is a sense that our society will be hurt if fewer men have degrees, and so a lot of colleges are working on it.
Rona Free again, president of University of St. Joseph. School's about to start. We've got 99 male students now in your undergraduate program. Moving forward, how are you going to, overseeing this change and engaging your student body, and if it's working for USJ?
So far, it's working. The number of students living on campus has gone up from 230 to 330. So that was one of our major goals, was to get more students living on campus, create a very engaged campus environment. So I think that will continue to rise. We'll continue to focus on engaging our students with the community and making sure that our students continue to be well-prepared academically.
Rona Free, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Also, Scott Jasik, editor at Inside Higher Ed, will tweet out a link to his story. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
This Bye. Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Learn more about the show at WNPR.org/where we live.